Hello, and welcome to Savor, a production of iHeartRadio and Stuff Media. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum, and today we're talking about pavlova.
Mm-hmm. I'm a little nervous, I gotta say.
You look terrified.
Well, a lot of you have written in and requested this one.
Uh-huh.
And mostly it's people arguing or are making their case that it's either from New Zealand or Australia. I feel like this is going to be a slightly more controversial, like our ice cream sundae episode.
Oh, yeah.
People have, they're very passionate about it.
They are. Well, I mean, it's a lovely dessert and, you know, national claims to fame are culturally important, so.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that I've had one. I probably have.
I have not. I've had a baked Alaska, which is similar.
Yeah, I feel like I've had something at least in this ballpark.
Yeah, like a meringue kind of thing.
I definitely had a meringue time kind of thing in my lifetime. But okay, this brings us to our question.
Mm-hmm.
Pavlova. What is it?
Well, a pavlova is a dessert that consists of a layer or layers of baked meringue topped with stuff, often slices or dices of fresh fruit, plus whipped cream. And when I say baked meringue, I mean egg whites that have been beaten with sugar until they're fluffy and peaky, and then baked until the mass is like creamy and soft and marshmallowy on the inside, but crisp and chewy on the outside with just a little bit of like crunchy crisp right along the edges.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And often a light vanilla flavoring to it. Mm-hmm. The fruit is often something bright and like a little tart to contrast with the sweetness of the meringue and add a pop of color, raspberries, strawberries, passion fruit, kiwi fruit. It's served room temperature. Once you top it, you want to serve it immediately to preserve those contrasting textures because the meringue will melt a little bit when exposed to moisture or acid. The result is lovely as a warm weather dessert. It's light and fluffy and sweet tart and just a little creamy. If you've never had one at all and you don't know what meringue is, I'd say it's a little bit like an angel food cake with completely different textures.
Yeah, it's hard to describe. We love color theory on this show.
We do.
We do. And I've found, and we'll touch on this a little later, but an article about how it became this, like, show-offy dainty dessert. And mm-hmm. the fruits were chosen specifically to, like, add that pop of color against the white.
Oh, of course. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And since it's frequently a Christmas treat in New Zealand and Australia, as their warm months are their Christmas season, the red and the green of something like strawberries and kiwi is mm-hmm. often plays in. But there are endless variations. Any type of fruit, fresh or macerated in sugar to form like a little bit of a sauce, or soaked in wine or juice or any flavored syrup you can think of. You can swap out the whipped cream for tangy yogurt or rich custard or ice cream or sorbet. Heck, freeze the whole pavlova. Pile chocolate or crunchy crumble or chopped nuts or caramel sauce or fruit curd or a drizzle of liquor on there. Basically, you know, ice cream sundae rules apply here in that there are no rules.
Oh, I love it.
Mm-hmm. You can technically make one that is sugar-free or vegan thanks to food science. And the meringue doesn't need to be plain vanilla. You can spike it with anything from like delicate like rose or orange blossom water to strong coffee or cocoa, as long as you don't muck up the chemistry too much for the meringue to set. And more on that later on.
I have been there. I have been there. I blame the humidity. Always blame the humidity.
Yeah.
Thank you. What about the nutrition?
As always, it depends. Meringue by itself is high in sugar, does have a little bit of protein. Your toppings can make pavlova either fairly light or fairly decadent. If you are trying to lighten yours, opt for unadulterated fresh fruit and a lightly sweetened or flavored yogurt instead of that whipped cream.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Numbers aren't the easiest to come by, but one thing I found so funny, telling, and fascinating is that you can buy pre-made pavlova shells in Australia and New Zealand.
Yeah, the company that dominates New Zealand's market is called Cowell's Genuine Pavlova, and it makes some 70% of the commercially sold pavlova shells in the country. They make 7,000 pavlova shells every day of the week during Christmas season. The holidays account for 80% of their yearly sales, and I love this one. To help with delivery across the country, they partner with Mainland Poultry, which is an egg supplier, and this egg supplier will deliver Cowell's Pavlova along with eggs to North Island.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
I like that, too. And as we alluded to at the top, both Australia and New Zealand strongly lay claim to the pavlova, or pav, as it's often shortened to.
Mm-hmm.
But who is right? Intrigue. Well, we'll get into that after a quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
All right. So, history. Did the history of the pavlova start in Australia or in New Zealand?
Everybody, take a deep breath. Neither!
Oh!
Oh! Probably. When everyone's shouting at whatever device you're using to listen to this. So wait.
Okay. Yes. Deep breaths. Annie, explain yourself.
I'll try. But let's talk about ballet first.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's divert. Divert for a second. It is relevant. Did you ever do ballet, Lauren?
It was one of the three, like, physical activity things that my mom tried to get me into when I was very tiny, none of which stuck. Social anxiety is hilarious. So, like, I would get a few months into any of them and they would be like, okay, now perform in front of the class. And I would be like, no. 6-year-old Lauren was like, I am not having that.
I'm leaving.
Basically did.
What were the other two?
Figure skating and gymnastics.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I did gymnastics and ballet.
Yeah.
I am kind of angry. I had a similar thing with gymnastics. I stuck with it for years. I did it years. And then my teacher came to my house once. Like, I didn't know she was coming. She just kind of dropped in unexpectedly and was like, it's time for you to compete. And I was like, I quit.
Oh, wow.
Because I was so nervous.
Yeah.
I am not good enough to compete. I wish I had stuck with it. But
yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, I feel like you would be great at gymnastics.
There's a timeline where I probably got third place somewhere.
Yeah. You could totally actually be the Winter Soldier if you had stuck with gymnastics.
Oh, man. You're right. Maybe my alternate persona, whoever she is, maybe she stuck with it.
All right.
Anyway, I hope everyone's calmed down a little bit.
All right, ballet.
Yes. In 1926, Russian ballerina Anna Pavlova was on tour in Australia and New Zealand. So, yes, spoiler alert, that is where the name of this dessert comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Pavlova was a worldwide, bona fide, huge deal at the time, and chefs around the globe named things after her,
mm-hmm.
like frog legs a la Pavlova in France, because they were like her legs.
Oh, aw.
Yeah.
That's kind of weird,
it's
but
weird
sure.
And, yeah,
okay,
I appreciate
I'll take it.
Pavlova ice cream in the United States. There's a recipe for a dessert called Strawberries Pavlova from 1911 out of Auckland, New Zealand, but it's not really a pavlova. It gets thrown around a lot in this debate around who invented it, but
okay.
It's not really the – not. I would say it shouldn't be involved. I mention it, but we should move on.
Because it had the same name, but it
yes.
was a different dessert.
Exactly.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And as you might guess, there are at least two versions of this origin story. The New Zealand one goes that while Anna Pavlova was in New Zealand in 1929, a chef at a Wellington hotel wanted to create a dessert in her honor, one that was reminiscent of her tutu.
Okay.
Yeah, and her tutu at the time was really beautiful. It was like draped in silk green roses, and it was airy and billowy. So, Pavlova dessert.
Pavlova, sure.
Airy,
okay.
Billowy. I don't know if you can apply that to dessert, but you know what I mean.
No, I think you can. Totes.
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 Thanks. The Australian version is essentially the same thing, except the hotel was in Perth, which is the only Australian city I have not been to.
Huh.
And the name was inspired by a diner who proclaimed it to be light as air, like Anna Pavlova. Although, I also read that the first Australian recipe for a pavlova in 1926... Oh, there's so much debate about that, too. We'll get into that in a minute. They just didn't call it a pavlova. So they were making a thing.
That was this dessert.
Yes.
Not calling it pavlova.
Right. So, if you go down that vein, New Zealanders say that they coined the name, but Australia says that they invented the dessert.
Okay.
Yes. The name in this version came along in 1935 as a tribute to Pavlova after her death, courtesy of Howard Soxa at the Esplanade Hotel in Perth, which is in Australia. That's all very confusing.
Yes.
Okay.
But
you know who weighs in on this debate?
Who?
The Oxford English Dictionary.
Dang!
It warranted a curse word.
It did.
According to them, the first mention of the Pavlova dessert happened in 1927, courtesy of New Zealand's Davis Gelantine. Or should I say a dessert called Pavlova, because unlike our modern iteration, did not involve meringue. People argue over whether it can rightfully be called the Pavlova. It was multi-layered jelly, but no meringue.
Okay.
So don't celebrate too quickly, New Zealand. A lot of people point to that. The Oxford English Dictionary does, but hold on. Australians say that it was an Australian chef who thought of adding meringue to this already named Pavlova dessert from New Zealand so that they should get the credit. This is all, like, so convoluted, and I love it. But twist!
Wait, there's a twist?
There is a twist!
Okay.
According to New Zealander Dr. Andrew Paul Wood and Australian Annabelle Utrecht, neither country can lay claim to it.
Ooh.
Nope, they give it to, drumroll please, Germany, Great Britain, and USA! You have to say it like that. It's required. we're not trying to stir anything up. These are an Australian and a New Zealander. They spent 2 years digging through recipes, and they found recipes for meringue-based Pavlova-esque cakes 150 years before Anna Pavlova ever went on this fabled tour in New Zealand and Australia.
Wow. Oof.
Yeah, and they were looking to prove each other wrong, by the way. They like, ran into each other on a Facebook, like, fight about New Zealand invented it. No, Australia did.
And they were like, fine, we'll go research it. And then they were like, oh.
Oh, no.
Oh, heck.
Yeah, and they researched it. They did. They spent up to 18 hours a day delving through 20,000 newspapers and 10,000 cookbooks. They call themselves the Doc and the Frock, and their website is lovely. It's very tongue-in-cheek, so I recommend it.
Meanwhile, meringues had been around in Europe since at least 1691. Recipes for it do show up in France and Switzerland.
Spanische Windtorte, a cake of meringue, fruit, and cream, goes back to the 18th century, and the Austrian Habsburgs, who loved it, they called it, quote, one of the most stunning cakes. German immigrants brought similar recipes with them to the American Midwest. Schaumtorte, or foam cake, which was often mispronounced as charm cake, and Baisertorte, or kiss cake. One thing that helped make meringue in general pretty popular, particularly among American housewives at this time, was the late 1800s innovation of the hand-cranked egg beater. This was a big deal.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because before you might spend upwards of 45 minutes to get a meringue. Like,
oh, yeah, just hand beating those egg whites. I mean, even now, you'll probably spend about 20 minutes beating egg whites with an electric beater, like 10 to 20, depending on, you know, your veracity.
Your veracity or your electric beater's veracity?
You know, honestly, it's both.
You got to work together.
You do.
I think we saw one of these hand-crank egg beaters.
Yeah.
At
SOFAB,
yeah.
The Southern...
Southern Food and Beverage Museum.
That one, yes.
Yes. It was a lovely, lovely museum. It had a table full of what looked like torture devices.
That are actually just old cooking devices that you can play with.
Yep. Highly recommend.
Mm-hmm. That's in New Orleans.
Yes. Don Thornton called this hand-crank egg beater America's greatest invention.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Strong words. I
mm-hmm,
like it.
Mm-hmm.
So if this is true, how did this not yet named Pavlova type dessert make its way to Australia and New Zealand?
Back of a cornstarch box. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, that's according to the two researchers. And, I mean, you can, yeah, it seems legit. So, cornstarch is a generally accepted ingredient in pavlova. Mm-hmm. And an American cornstarch company, William Duryea's Maizena, circa 1864, put a recipe for pavlova on its box to showcase something that you could make with it. And at some point, exported this product to New Zealand sometime in the 1890s. That's what is believed. By 1940, New Zealand cookbooks had 21 recipes for pavlova. Australia didn't get a printed one until that same year. Again, that is disputed because of the name and the what it actually is.
Okay, okay, sure.
Yes. Yeah, some people, going back to that 1935, that hotel in Perth, say that that was pavlova. It was just a pavlova by a different name. Anyway, if we go back to the U.S., in the 1940s, we get forgotten cake, which is a meringue cake that is placed in an oven set to high heat. It's turned off and left for 8 hours. Forgotten. And there was a shift here because the cake went from one with fruit jelly filling to a meringue topped with cream and fruit.
Huh.
Yes.
Okay.
Right before we came in to record, I found this academic paper on ironic nationalism and performative feminism and pavlova. I'm so angry I found it right before we came in. But it touched on how this dessert took a hit because of egg rationing during wartime. And then it experienced this post-war rebound. And it kind of became, for a little while, this dessert that was associated with, like, showiness, like dinner parties. It was expensive. And it was a way for women particularly to, like, show off their kind of defemininity, which is what you wanted.
Oh, sure, yeah. So sort of like aspics and
yes.
And other gelatin desserts
right.
Over here. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You were showing, like, look at this beautiful thing.
Look at the time and money I have to spend doing this.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And this paper said that by the 1950s, pavlova's popularity had solidified in both countries.
With this solidified popularity, in the mid-60s, this British couple who were living in Dunedin, New Zealand, founded Cowell's Coffee Shop. And this cafe's pavlovas became so popular that they wound up opening dedicated bakeries starting in the 1970s and began distributing to supermarkets all over the country.
In 1985, both New Zealand and Australia nominated the pavlova for a fundraiser when asked by Samoa to bring, like, a national dessert.
Oh.
And when David Burton wrote about it, he said, quote, "The fury resounded in the national press of both countries."
The fury.
I love it.
Oh, resounding fury.
Mm-hmm. I found a commercial for a New Zealand insurance company that claimed, "Everyone is always stealing your stuff, New Zealand. That's why you need insurance." And it ended on an image of the pavlova.
Oh, snap.
Yep.
Insurance company snap. I love it.
I know.
Okay.
So this is what we present to you.
Uh-huh.
Again, researchers, we find the information and we put it out there.
Yes. We're not taking sides.
Mm-mm.
We, you know.
Yeah, I apologize about my very triumphant USA champ. But that wasn't me taking a side.
It was just dramatic reading of the facts.
Yeah. I like a dramatic reading. I think everyone who listens to the show probably knows that.
Probably.
You're both winners in our book, though, New Zealand and Australia, because you took this dessert and you ran with it.
Yes.
No one embraced it with the same fervor as you did.
No. Aw. Well, okay. This debate is certainly enough to have kept all of us on our toes.
Belly pun.
Another thing that can keep you on your proverbial toes is the anxiety that creating a pavlova can create in you. Luckily, there's some science to help you out. And we'll be back with that after we get back from a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you. And we are back with another eggy science segment.
More egg science.
More egg science. Because meringue, y'all, is persnickety.
Mm-hmm.
What you're aiming to do here is beat your egg whites and sugar together until they're just stiff enough to hold up in the oven until the heat can firm them and set the structure. If you underbeat, you'll get soft collapsed gloop. And if you overbeat, you'll get stiff collapsed gloop. So let's break down the science of what's happening when you make meringue, and then we'll add in some troubleshooting tips toward the end.
Sounds good.
Okay. So when you're making a meringue for a pavlova or any other purpose, you're only using the whites of the egg, and that's because the yolks contain fats, which would ruin the structure. Egg whites are about 90% water and 10% protein. And now what you're looking to do here is create a network of stable bubbles in those egg whites. Think of that foamy texture of meringue. It's exactly the way that bubbles in, like, straight-up water do not behave. Because you can use a whip to beat air bubbles into water, but they'll release out quickly. Water molecules stick together, electrically speaking, and push air out. But in an egg white, you've got those proteins to work with. A thing that we didn't get to talk about in our deviled egg episode was how those proteins behave when you expose them to manual whipping. But as it turns out, it's pretty much the same thing that happens during heating. Because heating, after all, means you're agitating the molecules of a substance. You're making them bounce around into each other. Either manual or heat agitation results in the proteins and egg whites unfurling. These proteins are our chains that contain both hydrophilic bits and hydrophobic bits. They start out curled up in these wee bundles with their water-loving bits on the outside, hanging on to the egg white's water molecules, and the water-fearing bits safe and wrapped up on the inside. Agitation makes them unfurl, and once unfurled, the water-fearing bits will start connecting up with one another, forming a sort of a lattice or matrix. And you want to start with room temperature eggs for this reason, because cold egg proteins will take longer to unfurl and link up. Extra arm time. Don't want it.
No.
Or maybe you do. Yeah, I mean, you know.
You're looking for a workout.
You choose your battles. Meanwhile, the other thing that's happening during whipping is that you're introducing pockets of air into the mix. And now it might sound counterintuitive, but the air adds structure. That's because the air gives the water-fearing bits something to move toward and something to kind of shape themselves around. The water-loving bits will happily grab onto the water molecules, and the water-fearing bits will therefore kind of stick out into the air all willy-nilly. But then they can link up, forming their own, like, wee safe surfaces around the air bubbles away from the water. This also, like elbow holds the water molecules far enough away from one another that their electrical attraction will lessen, and they'll be okay with, like, spreading out and allowing the air bubbles to hang around. Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. You can think of it like like if you're a shy nerd in a group of outgoing nerds.
Okay.
Like, just for example, not from personal experience at all.
No.
If you're, like, a sci-fi weirdo who's hanging out with a bunch of, like, theater weirdos, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You all go to a party. The shy one, you know, me, maybe, just, you know.
In this example, hypothetically. Yeah.
It's going to kind of stick in the middle of the clique until some kind of action exposes you to air. And then you're like, this is great, actually. And is that a person wearing a Buffy t-shirt? Let me make fast friends with them.
Yeah.
And so the two social fearing folks form a solid but, like, maybe kind of at arm's length bond with each other, mm-hmm. their own little air pocket, if you will,
yeah.
while the social loving folks will bond up in the thick of the crowd.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Definitely not you.
No, I. So anyway,
mm-hmm.
then to this mixture, the egg whites more than the people, you add sugar, because sugar will keep the structure stable by also bonding with the water molecules and preventing them from evaporating out so quickly during baking. The same goes for adding a little bit of cornstarch. And in our metaphor, I guess this is like how adding booze to a party will help keep people around.
Yeah.
Sure.
Uh-huh.
You don't want to add the sugar or cornstarch too early, though, because it will interfere with the protein structure setting up. Same with booze, I guess. Really, like, too much too early is not helpful to a party.
Nope, but it'll be an interesting story later.
I guess it does depend on what kind of party you're looking for. Okay, so once you've got this sugar and egg white mixture, baking it at a nice low temperature will let those egg proteins stiffen up and set the meringue. And I think my metaphor is collapsing at that part. But speaking of collapsing, like I said at the top of the section, under or overbeating can lead to a sad, flat pavlova. In the case of overbeating, you've forced your proteins to make too many connections with one another, which can force water out of the structure. And you do need the water in there because when it escapes as steam during cooking, after the structure has set, it leaves little air pockets where the water used to be, creating a foamier foam. So you can prevent overbeating by adding a little vinegar or lemon juice or like whatever acid to the meringue batter, which will neutralize some of the protein molecules and prevent them from linking up too much. Another thing that will interfere with the structure is fats. They'll coat the air bubbles and prevent your proteins from linking up correctly, which means that for best results, don't touch your egg whites with your dirty human hands while you're separating them, because oils on your fingers can make their way in that way. Also, make sure that no egg yolk gets in. That's the part that contains the fats. And use a metal or glass bowl to whip in. Fats stick to plastics more readily than to metal or glass, so plastic bowls, no matter how well you wash them, can spell doom. Doom!
Not doom.
Doom. For extra best results, wipe down your bowl with a little bit of lemon juice before you start.
Yeah.
If you suspect that you have overbeaten your eggs, like they're clumping and kind of leaking water, you can add a fresh egg white and beat again until the mixture is shiny and smooth. Or you can try that. I mean, it's not guaranteed, but it might help.
Okay, good to know.
Yeah. And if, against all efforts, your meringue cracks or deflates in the oven, look, y'all, like, it might be less pretty, but, like, it's probably still going to taste okay. You might need a little bit more, like, wet topping, like whipped cream or whatever, to make up the texture. No nose. More whipped cream.
That sounds like hell to me. I love whipped cream.
I love whipped cream. There's nothing bad about it.
Oh, man.
So
we
gotta
do that episode.
Ooh, oh, geez. Okay. And, yeah, that's my eggy science segment.
Love it. I've successfully made meringue once or twice. But I did do it, like, usually recipes, the good ones will say, like, yeah, use a metal bowl and make sure it's clean and all of those things.
Add a little cornstarch, do the, little bit of acid, sure. Yeah. It's good to know why.
It is. It is good. I just take for granted, oh, this is how you do it. And now I learn so much from you, Lauren.
Aw, I learned so much from you.
That's why we make a great team.
It is.
A great podcasting team. Perhaps a controversial topic we presented, but.
Yeah, no, it's okay, yeah. And I think we made our way through it fairly well.
I think so. I love when I find out a dessert or a food is named after somebody. That's one of my favorite things.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I hope that somehow, like, someone somewhere appreciates the legacy of their relative having this.
Ooh. Oh, I would.
Yeah.
I've said before about one of my goals is to have a food named after me. I want a sandwich or something.
Well, we're working towards it every day, every episode.
Yes. Getting one step closer. But I think that about brings us to the end of this episode and to
listener mail. Like USA?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Oh, I always love it when you get it because sometimes I know they're a mess. It's all up here. So I have two short ones that are tips. One is from Tori, who wrote, I just finished listening to your onion episode, and I'm surprised you didn't mention my favorite onion cutting tip. Chewing minty gum while chopping an onion greatly reduces the crying factor and combats the strong smell. Interesting.
Oh.
I thought, you know, the timing is we just did mint.
Sure.
Fortuitous.
Yeah.
Folks out there, if you're looking for, if your onion goggles aren't doing it, give this a try.
Sure.
And this tip from Cassie, my friend and I hard-boiled about a dozen eggs each for our work trip this week, and I wanted to share a tip my mom shared with me as a kid for hard-to-peel eggs. Simply crack the shell and start a small portion and slip the spoon under the shell to separate the shell and membrane from the egg.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've watched people do that one, and it's like magic.
Okay.
Yeah. It's intense.
I'll have to share with my mom. Like I said, she hates peeling hard-boiled eggs, so maybe that's the way for her.
I've got a Passover Seder coming up, so I'll have to remember that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Report back.
Oh, absolutely. Will do. Kristen wrote, I hail from the pretzel state, I mean Pennsylvania. We definitely do take our pretzels seriously. Many families have their favorite company of both pretzels and potato chips. It is a point of Pennsylvania Dutch tradition / habit to have a dessert with both sweet and salty. The salty is often in the form of pretzels. Growing up, we'd have our meal and then Dad would grab the pretzel jar. Yes, we had a particular canister that was used for solely holding pretzels. Dinner was not officially over until we had all had a few pretzels. For my wedding, my husband and I skipped having cake and instead did an ice cream sundae bar. Ooh. To stand in for the traditional cake feeding, we fed each other ice cream on pretzels. All this to say, your estimate that Pennsylvania residents eat about 12 pounds of pretzels sounds right on.
I love it. Ice cream, pretzels.
That's beautiful.
I know. I have a real newfound appreciation for pretzels. I think I took them for granted.
Yeah. I hadn't. Oh, man. We're both just like thinking about pretzels now. We're just like dead air. We're both like looking off into the middle distance.
America face. Making America face. This has been that episode is one that inspired a lot of people to write in. So keep that up. And also, we wanted to bring back our request for pictures of pets with food names.
Oh, yeah. We realized in talking to producer Andrew before the show that he came on long after we last made that request. And we just really like pictures of pets, y'all. And some of you have the best ones.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them have excellent names. And we would love to see them.
Yes. We're renewing the call.
Yeah.
Maybe people have already sent in pictures. You've got new pictures.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Don't feel poorly about doubling up.
No, never.
But maybe there's some new topics we've covered. Maybe you've got a pretzel or an onion in your house.
Oh, those are both good pet names.
Right?
Yeah. All right. So, request made.
Yes. Oh, I think onion especially because it bites.
Ooh. Yeah. I like it.
Anyway.
Maybe we're giving people ideas, too.
Ooh.
Thanks to all of them for writing in. If you would like to write to us, you can. Our email is hello@saverpod.com.
We're also on social media. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. That's the other one. Yes, all at SaverPod. We'd love to hear from you. Saver is a production of iHeartRadio and Stuff Media. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Thanks, as always, to our super producers, Andrew Howard and Dylan Fagan. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.